This podcast is part of the Podcast Arcade Network.
Hello, today I've got Tim Benson with me as we discuss Ghosts in the Shell from 1995. We'll talk about the original manga, the movie, a little bit about the TV series, and the new movie coming out today. All coming up on Soundtrack Alley. Tim, it's
hey,
nice.
How's it going?
All right. It's good to have you on the show again.
Always good.
Yeah. Today we've got good, exciting news about Ghosts in the Shell. The live action movie comes out today. What are your thoughts initially on, have you seen any previews for the new movie?
Yeah, you know, I come into it with no history at all. When you suggested the episode, I hadn't read the book, hadn't seen the anime, hadn't seen the show, but I had seen the previews for the movie, and I'm okay with it. You know, like I said, I'm not offended by any of the story going on around it, and I like sci-fi movies, so I'll probably like the live-action movie more than any of the other stuff, just because it's a fresh take for me.
Yeah, yeah. That's how I was looking at it. I mean, some of the aspects of the previews really remind me of the manga, or not the manga, but the anime, the Ghost in the Shell anime.
Yeah.
It's a unique take on it, and I don't know why people are talking about it being whitewashed and everything, because I don't know what they expect. So.
Yeah, it's a movie made in America, and I get it. Like, I would have no problem if the star of the film was an American Asian descent. I'm fine with it, whatever. Whoever does the role best, but it's a movie.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to sell tickets to pay for its budget. She brings, you know, the actress playing the lead role. She's going to put people in the seats. So,
yeah.
Okay, and I think I always go back to the idea that, you know, they've done interviews with people in Japan. There's another podcast I listened to. They did a whole section on this, and they interviewed people in Japan, in China, and they asked them what they thought about Ghost in the Shell specifically,
mm-hmm.
Casting somebody, and they're like, we don't really care. Like, mm-hmm. We have our own movie industry.
Yeah.
You guys can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to make Ghost in the Shell someday, and we'll put a Japanese person in the lead, and you guys can make a movie. And they just don't care.
Yeah.
I think most of the outcry about it is just clickbait internet articles.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And one of the things I noticed was that with the new movie coming out, this is something very specific to today's release of Ghost in the Shell, is that in Japan, when they release this movie, the American movie in Japan, they're having the Japanese original voice actors dub over for everything in this film.
Yeah.
Which is
awesome. It, so.
I mean, that is so cool, because it's like, it gives you a sense of callback to the original anime. And
yeah.
I found that really compelling, because it's like, yeah, that gives you the connection that you're really looking for, that these actors, the people are familiar with those people voicing those characters.
Yeah. No, I think that was a brilliant move on their part. And I think all of the just anger and dislike surrounding the movie is just some people trying to get hits to their internet site to sell ad revenue. And I just don't worry about it too much.
Yeah, yeah. And then the fact that the main character, which is Motoko, I guess with the new movie, she's just called Major, which doesn't really make any sense, but hey, we're talking about a science fiction cyberpunk anime that doesn't exist, really, so...
Well, yeah, I mean, and I'm sure it's not a straight adaptation.
No, I don't think it is. It's got its own story. In fact, I think the story is actually different from what even the anime is, so...
Yeah, they didn't just whitewash the actors. I mean, they whitewashed the story because it's a movie made in America.
Yeah.
And whether you're white or not, I don't really care for the whitewash term. Whether you're white or not, you've grown up on a certain visual style.
Yeah.
And like, I have no problem with manga or anime, but I'm not used to it.
So it takes
an effort, not an effort to watch it, but an effort to like kind of get yourself in the mindset for it, which is why when you suggested it, I said I wanted to read the book first.
Oh, yeah.
To kind of get into the aesthetic feel for the style they make the movie and they make the books. And the movie is going to be fine. I'll see it. So
yeah, I'm actually looking forward to seeing it. Well, let's start off with some thoughts on the actual manga. Since you have read quite a bit of it, what did you really think of the manga for Ghost in the Shell?
It was okay. There were some parts of it that it kind of showed its age, and maybe they went, maybe the I forget the name of the person who writes and draws it.
I have it right here. It's Masamune Shiro.
Yeah. There were some, I guess it comes down to it, is like way too much nudity or the implication of nudity.
Uh-huh.
For no reason. Like, I'm fine with nudity being in a show or a book or anything like that, but he took it way past necessary.
And I agree.
And way past storytelling. It was just there for the readers to enjoy, you know?
Yeah, and it was actually uncalled for. And yeah. I think it was, I don't know what it is with his style, but he created art books full of overly sexualized women in skimpy outfits, and it had no relevance to technology or no relevance to any type of story. He just wanted to draw sexy women.
Yeah, and you know what? I don't have a problem with it. I just don't. That's just not my entertainment, you know?
Yeah.
So there was that, but beyond that, it was fine. The technology part of it is probably my favorite, and I loved the notes that he makes that are like somebody else is giving you reference, and you really start to feel the ghost. From page one, you feel the ghost giving you information that the rest of the world doesn't understand. So I liked that. Little notes about, like, the very opening scene, the guy gets shot and then explodes.
Yeah.
I was so confused until I noticed the little notes. And
yeah,
that's when it really kind of took on a better understanding for me. And you kind of look for those little tidbits first. And then I'm going to try to stay on topic, but watching the anime, you kind of get the same feeling when she plugs in and takes over the vehicle.
Yeah.
And starts talking to him, to the guy who was driving. She starts talking to him, but her body isn't moving or making the sounds. And you start to, like, where is this sound coming from?
It's from the...
She doesn't have to move her mouth.
Yeah.
It's a speaker.
Yeah.
So I liked how they tied together. So I liked the little notes throughout in the book that really play on the ghost. So.
Yeah, and I mean it shows like, you know, a possible future that technology has reached an advanced point to where so many members have a cyber brain that part of their technology is to interface with the biological brain and connect with various networks. And that includes contacting or communicating with others through that network. And that's what you're shown in the manga, and you're also shown that in the anime between Motoko and Bato.
Yeah.
Her and him, they have a long exchange between each other that they're not speaking at all, but it's all in their head. And they're communicating, and you're getting a sense of part of their relationship and their story. I just found it really unique that it's a different type of storytelling.
Yeah. I mean, the play with technology and organisms is, I mean, that's what made it popular. I mean, it's the cyberpunk move. Mm-hmm. So I wonder what the connection between American like literature, like Gibson, William Gibson,
or, oh yeah,
even P.K. Dick's early stuff versus, like, I wonder if it had an influence on this, or if it's simply the emergence of technology in both American and Japanese culture that it's bound to happen.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't need to actually be influenced. The technology is just taking over the world. Of course, you're going to start to see it in literature. So I can't find anything specifically talking about references or even inspiration across the ocean.
Yeah.
Until after both of these are produced. So I find it interesting that both of them, I keep talking about them, William Gibson's Neuromancer.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder how much they interact with one another or if at all. So.
Yeah. I found it interesting with just the manga in general. The one thing that stands out to me is the technology. And even the, what are they called? They're the mobile attack units, but they don't have... I mean, they have personality, but they're robots.
The mobile armored riot police.
Yes.
That's the name of Ghost in the Shell in Japan.
Yeah. But like I don't know, they're like those tanks. Kichikomas.
Yeah.
The Kichikomas, they have like minds of their own too, but they're also controlled by the people. So I found that really interesting as well, because there's a point in the TV series where there's an entire episode where they're having this really in-depth conversation about life and consciousness and awareness for themselves. And it's actually a really compelling episode because it's like it gives you the thought of, you know, making things more real or seeing how these machines could change or adapt to be more like self-aware.
Yeah.
But I found it, I mean, it just was an interesting, you know, concept even in the manga. So, but moving on, like, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the manga itself and the artwork style and how we both don't really like the artwork style.
I like the artwork. I just don't like the content. Yeah. Or I don't like the excessive, just sexualized content.
Yeah.
If you took all those pages out, like it's a great book with or without them. I just didn't need the amount that he put in.
Oh, I agree.
I also understand, like, I mean, the main character is female. She's a robot. And so it was like pushing the censorship line at a time when it was very heavily censored, you know, but because she wasn't human, it wasn't nudity.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that there was a reason for the, I guess, the scenes, the new, all of that, that pushed boundaries that were outside of the page. I mean, he was trying to make points about censorship and body images in Japanese culture. You know, but it's been a long time. It's hard for me. It's hard to look back with that lens. But
yeah.
But I did like the actual art of the book. I thought he paced it well. Settings, location, just the style of it itself was really good.
And he's done other things such as Appleseed and Dominion Tank Police. And those were all mangas originally, and then they became animes after that.
Anime and mangas is definitely a spot in my reading and watching history that isn't very thorough.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like all the other people in the world who thinks Akira, you know, is great. And I can't wait to do the Akira episode.
Yeah.
But I could tell you, I've probably read 5 and watched 5 anime manga series in my life. So mm-hmm. I don't come to it with a lot of training.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly fine. But, you know, when we look at the actual anime in general, you know, the very beginning sequence and the whole, like, cyberization of this character. I looked up this one article to recreate the actual scene for the new movie. The special effects people, they actually worked with the live-action shelling sequence, like the person being, you know, given skin and everything. It gives the idea of how much the sequence was created using even practical effects rather than computer-generated imagery. And it had a physical 1,400-piece skeleton modeled on Johansson's body, or Johansson, and a body lifted from real liquid filmed against a green screen. So they used those practical effects to get that same idea from the first sequence in the anime.
Yeah.
I found that just unique. The director, being Mamoru Oshii, I think I said that right. I probably I probably butchered it, but
yeah.
He's been known to direct many other things other than Ghost in the Shell. His early works were on Urusei Yatsura, and it's like this cat girl, and they had 15 seasons of the TV show, and then they did several movies, and it was super big and super popular in Japan.
Yeah.
And then he did a show called Pat Labor, and it's like a militaristic, like, robotic mecha. You know, like,
oh, yeah,
giant robots. And so he was known for doing films like that. And then when he did Ghost in the Shell, he modeled it from things of Final Fantasy. And then he did this one called Angel's Egg. And he was starting to get into, like, the cyber type, you know, ideas. And yeah. So it changed, you know, a lot of things. And in fact, when we look at, you know, Ghost in the Shell in general, it was kind of a stepping stone to what The Matrix was.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, he was one of the directors for the animated Matrix, whatever, Animatrix.
Yes, the Animatrix,
I
yep.
I never saw that.
Yep, I haven't.
There's definitely a connection. And he was one of the guys who could go back and forth between live action and animated.
Yeah.
And it shows in Ghost in the Shell anime. I mean, it definitely shows how much work he puts into the background and the setting and camera angles. I mean, in animation, you can camera angle from anywhere you want.
Yeah.
But he chooses angles that he would have chosen if it was a live action film. And I think that's one of the reasons it has kind of taken on a life bigger than others because there's a cinematography to it that people can associate with.
Oh, yeah. I definitely agree. Because there's so much about that film, like the hyper-realness of the action really, you know, really gets you because it's like, wow, that's really fast, or, you know, and it's all animated, but you feel like you're watching a live action movie in some ways because of some of the action that's actually going on.
Yeah.
I found it unique for the movie itself. What do you think of the music for the anime?
Yeah, I think he uses it well. You know, during most of the action scenes, it's pretty subdued.
Oh, yeah.
The sound effects are really notched up quite a bit, so the music takes a back seat. But some of my favorite parts in the anime are just the, you know, the where she's sitting in the water. Mm-hmm. Or just she's floating. That's the word I'm looking for. She's floating in the water, or she takes the subway.
Yeah.
And it's literally just her thinking.
Mm-hmm.
The music really takes the front seat to all of that. And you start to get the emotions of the character through the music. So I think he uses that really well in the way that, you know, you think about Blade Runner, stuff like that, where the music really has to tell a story in itself. For these non-human characters.
Yeah. Yeah, most definitely. Because you have a different type of storytelling. You're not watching a live-action film. You have to help it along with the music. And Kenji Kawai, who did the score, you could feel like the metallic parts of it, you know, giving it that cyberpunk feel. And then you also get some really unique aspects of Japanese instruments intertwined with the actual, you know, score. And I found it, you know, a unique blend of regular composition of film music and then mixed with that almost 80s style of composing, but not the synth type. You know, it was you can tell that there was actual real instruments used for the score.
Yeah, I don't know the technical terms or the equipment used, but it's like they created real, you know, live instrument music recordings, and then went in and added layers to them to give it a more electronic feel. Even the voices, you know, and that's something we haven't talked about. This is the first animated, right, that we've done?
Yes.
So we haven't talked about voice acting. But the cool thing about animated films is you really are able to separate voice from the live action. And I know you can do that now, but for older movies, it was harder.
Yeah.
But they were able to add those elements, the electronic effects, to the voices as well as the music. And they were able to meld the two together.
Mm-hmm.
Probably in a controllable way that you probably couldn't have done until 5 or 6 years ago. So,
yeah.
And I didn't know this, Brian Eno. I feel like Brian Eno is our guy because our first episode was Dune.
Yeah.
He makes his appearance again in this one.
Yeah. Yeah. It's phenomenal how certain people have influence over even different styles of filmmaking.
Yeah.
So, I just, you know, the whole idea of Ghost in the Shell and the way the music is done, when I've watched the entire Ghost in the Shell standalone complex TV series, and it's like 27 episodes, and it's all involving the Laughing Man. Now with the anime, it's the Puppet Master. And then there's the second series, which is still just like volume two, and it's dealing with this group called the Initial 11. Yeah. And so each series has its own, like, back, you know, kind of behind-the-scenes villain that's trying to control everything and change everything. So it's really unique how they get these different elements of a different character that is behind the scenes and is affecting everything that's involved.
I think it's, I've always read it as it's a sign of the time where technology was emerging, computers and their interactivity with the world was evolving, and this AI fear was kind of dominant in the way that people were afraid of hackers. Mm-hmm. You know, and like, you don't understand how hacking is done, and movies like this and Blade Runner and things like that were just kind of natural outreaches for fear of technology that you can't control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's the whole idea of Standalone Complex, which is the TV series. And it really delves deep into, like, the even moral issues dealing with the, you know, having a AI or having a cyberized brain that takes over functions of the body. In fact, there's a couple of the episodes of the TV series where you have a intelligence that is inside, like, a suitcase that's walking. And it's an intelligent human, but he has a cyber brain. So it's, you know, there's no physical human being there, but it's just this, like, walking suitcase.
Yeah.
So it clearly changes, you know, moral implications, and it reminds me of the book by Roger McBride Allen called The Modular Man, and how The Modular Man, it was an experiment of a man that decided to merge his consciousness into a robot form. And so he did it, but it took a few weeks for him to fully integrate into the robotic self. And it just was a really interesting novel. And maybe even the director got his ideas from that very book or just other science fiction book ideas or something like that, because that's essentially what was happening.
Yeah.
So,
I read the first one. I didn't go beyond that to read volume two or volume, you know, 1.5.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And, yeah.
And I haven't checked out the TV show.
Well, so I can,
we'll see.
I can definitely tell you that the TV show is really compelling. Some of it's kind of brutal.
Yeah.
Because there's some things in it that you're not expecting. And it's not a TV show for children at all.
Well, no.
It is like an adult TV series. You know, it's like a full adult TV series. And you have to really weigh it carefully to see how it's going to affect. And I found it really interesting and really good, because the storyline of the Laughing Man lasts for 27 episodes, but you've got certain episodes that don't even deal with the Laughing Man. Like, they're waiting on something, and so that's how they explain this one episode, that it's a standalone, and that's why they call it the Standalone Complex.
I think you have to do that for a successful TV show.
Yeah. Otherwise, you can't have any fun with it or, you know, deviate from the main storyline, because otherwise the main storyline would only last like 7 episodes.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, we've discussed a little bit about the manga, the initial anime, and what are your thoughts on the plot of the anime?
I, it's I liked it. It's pretty accessible. You know, where you're able to, you come in and you have a couple of characters who really kind of bring you into this complex world.
Mm-hmm.
The technology is cool, and it kind of serves as a catalyst for some of the story.
Yeah.
And you kind of get this, the ghost in the anime, I think they're just like, oh yeah, there's a ghost in the machine. And you just have to kind of accept it. The manga brings it in a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably my only critique of
mm-hmm.
it.
Oh yeah.
Is that ghost concept is just forced, and they kind of throw it at you in a couple dialogue moments, mm-hmm. and they're like, yeah, there is a ghost. I think there's a ghost. Yeah, what if there's a ghost? And they kind of beat it over. But they could have just left that out. And, I mean, the thing is called Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah.
I'll pick up on the hints. You know, you don't have to go so heavy. But once they start bringing in the... I forget the names of all the characters, but the blonde android lady.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, once they bring her in, you're like, yeah, there's a ghost, you know?
Yeah.
And that's where it really, like, ratchets up quite a bit.
Yeah.
And you get these huge, you know, military industrial complex type places, and you start to see the city itself. Mm-hmm. You know, this is where they start taking the bus or the train ride through the city. It's a compelling story for sure.
Yeah, I found it unique of even how the animation style lends itself to the story and how you get so many elements of the story through the animation, and you get to see rather than read it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So one thing that I really found unique was, I mean, you really see the brutalness that happens within the last 10 minutes of the film, because Motoko is trying to rip the top off of this giant tank, and her arms are like breaking off because she can't do it. And finally, Bato, he comes in and saves her. So it's like, well, spoiler alert, but it's a film from 1995. So
yeah, you should have seen it.
Yeah. But, it's, you know, it's like it's a really rip-roaring action scene at the end of the film, and you're like, whoa!
Yeah.
And then you find out that, you know, later on she's able to have a borrowed body later on to be able to survive and get a better one later.
Yeah, I mean, the whole brain transplant is a well-played-out concept, but this was kind of an early stage for it. I'm interested to see how the new movie plays on some of the physical takes on it.
Yeah.
I'd love to see Scarlett, like, tear off a tank, you know, like, to start doing stuff to that physical extent.
Yeah.
And mainly because I think we need to see a Black Widow movie. Yeah. You know, so we need to see how well she can... not her as an actor, but like how well an audience receives that lead female strong character.
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure nobody's going to step in to save her.
No.
In the new movie. They want her to be the one saving. So.
Yeah. But we'll see.
Yeah.
Did you notice one thing with the anime that the director puts in a basset hound?
I didn't see that.
Yeah, there was a basset hound.
I didn't acknowledge it in any way.
Yeah, well, it's kind of his signature, because anything that he's done, he's put a basset hound in it. He did it in Dominion Tank Police, he did it in Appleseed, he's done it in Ghost in the Shell. It's even in the TV series. And then he did it in the sequel called Innocence, Ghost in the Shell Innocence. Now, that one is really good. I actually found that one more compelling than Ghost in the Shell itself. So, okay. And I don't think it has an English dub. I think you can only watch it in subtitle. So,
yeah.
But it's really good. So it's just unique because, you know, you look at certain directors, they have a signature such as John Woo and his dubs. He always has dubs in his movie. So those are things that, you know, you can really find interesting. So I've got a few cues by Kenji Kawai that I'd like to play since he had composed the music for Ghost in the Shell. And the first cue I have is called Resurrection, which is the very title cue of the film. And it shows us the introduction. So what are your thoughts on that intro, Tim?
And it definitely starts you off right away with that mix of traditional Japanese instrument with the technology.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to see that played. It's kind of the middle ground. Later on in the movie, you get real just instrumental pieces. And then toward the end, you get real heavy electronic sound. So I think the intro is a good middle ground. Same with the very last, you know, the credit song.
Yeah.
It's kind of a good mix between the two.
Oh, yeah, I would definitely agree. So now, let's play Resurrection. Well, next, I really like to show how the vision of the future for the film is, and the track that I have is called Ghost Hack. And it gives us a clue into that very situation, because you get these, like, singularity pings in the score, in the very track that we have, that it gives us, and it's spaced so far apart that you really wonder, is this still going on?
Yeah.
But then it's unique because it carries you along through the track to show that there's a cyber villain that's hacking other people.
Yeah.
So, what do you think?
This one, it really gives you the feel of, like, I'm going to spoil a future episode of Tron, but, like, what does a circuit board sound like?
Yeah.
And this is kind of a good example of what we've all come to understand as, if you see circuits on screen, this is the kind of sound you associate with it.
Yeah.
And it's just that basic electronic overlay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's for me, it's kind of the basic tech sound.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost a sound effect. Mm-hmm. Now.
Yeah.
So.
But it's a good track. So now let's play Ghost Hack. Thank you. Lastly, I'd like to play three tracks that are toward the conclusion of the score. It's called Night Stalker, Floating Museum, and Ghost Drive. Now, Ghost Drive is in regard to Motoko connecting with the Puppet Master to talk to him, and it, like, the Puppet Master, like, breaks through that communication between Motoko and Bato, and you get this, like, surreal Japanese feel for the music, and then it shows us the technical side of bringing us full circle of understanding what is actually going on, and even highlighting the frenetic action that opens the bars to the TV series as well. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think you hit it right on. There's those three tracks run well. It's kind of the end of the movie, and yeah.
All right. So once again, we've come to an end of a show. We can look forward to the next 2 weeks as I bring some composer interviews in. Next week, I've got Alec Alvarez and Freddie Shenfeld. They'll be on the show talking about the new Yu-Gi-Oh! Movie that had come out called Dark Side of Dimensions. So it's a really actually a very good interview. I enjoyed interviewing them, and it was a special treat from Beth Krakauer. I'd like to thank her for setting up the interview, and I was able to, you know, really reach out to those two composers, and I was able to get them on through Skype, and it's just a really phenomenal interview, so I'd like people to be able to enjoy that. And then the following week, I've got Bruce Roland, who composed the film music for The Man from Snowy River, and I'll present that interview and discuss the movie with Josh Howell from Daydream Instruction Manual. So those are a couple things that we can look forward to in the next couple weeks. And
you're on big time.
Yeah. And so, Tim, I'd like to thank you once again for being on the show.
Always good.
Yeah, and we'll look forward to doing more in the future. So for now, let's play these last three cues, and happy listening. Thank you.
Thank you. thank you for listening to Soundtrack Alley, the podcast. I hope you take some time to review my podcast on iTunes and also listen to it on Podbean. And if you leave a review or rating on there, it'll help us get noticed on iTunes. Thank you so much. Have a good day.